Welcome to the Vegan Report. My name is Ryan, and today we are asking the question, how do we keep vegan kids vegan? Being an adult vegan is already tough in terms of social pressure. It's not a surprise that most vegans will fall back to consuming animal products. So imagine how it is for kids who are raised vegans. What tools do they have to counter the carnist message they hear repeated in school, among friends, and from parents? How have we equipped them to persevere in holding to the ethical principles inculcated by their parents? And really, are we even thinking about them and how to support them in their struggle? Well, my guest today has some answers. Her name is Tracy Glover. She is the founder of Sweet Peeps Micro Sanctuary and the writer of the brand new children's book, Fanny Goes to Washington. Among other things, we discussed the antinatalism embraced by many vegans, her psychedelic experience, the real-life stories that inspired her book, and much, much more. You can order the book now. Visit the description for more details. Tracy, thank you so much for being here. A second time on this show. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me back.
So, yes, a second time because you are here for our Micro Sanctuary episode. Do you want maybe to share your thoughts on that episode once it was released, or, you know, if there was anything more you want to add to that contribution?
I don't know that there's anything I wanted to add, although I feel like I could always add things, but I don't know. It was great. It was such a great experience also to be, you know, connected to other sanctuaries really around the world. Right. Because it was Jessica in Ohio, I think. Oh gosh. Is it Ohio or Indiana? Somewhere in the Midwest.
Yes.
Somewhere up north. And then Alejandra in Colombia. Is that right?
Good question. Wait just a second. I'll look it up just to be.
Okay.
I'm horrible with names. I mean.
I know. As soon as I started to say that, I was like, "Why am I even getting myself into this trouble now? Because I'm terrible with names."
It's Jimena. It's Jimena. It's Jessica and Jimena, and Jessica have been two times on my podcast, and we talked, you know, off the show, and I still don't know where she is exactly. I could tell you, so
yeah,
shame on me. But
I guess I'm bad with names and locations.
Yes.
Although I'm pretty sure that Jimena is in Colombia. So, in any case, to be connected to people like literally, you know, just in very different parts of the world, that's the thing I think about, you know, one thing about having a sanctuary is like so few people understand really what my life is like, except for other sanctuary people understand it perfectly. And so there is kind of just like instant bond, I feel like, that comes, you know, with other sanctuary people wherever we are in the world. I mean, which is also true just, I think, you know, for vegans, right? It's like that's another connection that completely transcends nationalities and, you know, everything else is our, you know, our shared ethic. So the sanctuary episode, it was, you know, just great to get to connect with other sanctuary people, other vegans. And I think, you know, it sort of also reminded me, I guess, you know, how much sanctuary work is part of a larger movement to create a vegan world, and how, you know, what an important part it is. In part, I think, you know, it's like sometimes you can just get so absorbed in like the daily routine and caring for these specific animals and who's sick and who's well. And, you know, I can forget like that everything that we're doing here is connected to this larger movement. And honestly, it's like one of the things too, sorry, a little bit of a tangent, but like when we lose people here, you know, I'm just so devastated and heartbroken, and you kind of just, you know, just like with any loss in your life, right? You can just get so consumed with the grief of it, but then to remember again that it's like, you know, the animals who come here, even though they do pass away at some point, they are some of the luckiest animals on the planet. They get to live the life that they all deserve, and their lives matter and like have an impact even outside of, you know, this sanctuary, because we tell stories and other people are impacted. And sorry to get ahead of us, but like just a brief sort of segue into the book. The children's book is Chickens Are Animals Too, Fanny Goes to Washington. And Fanny was one of my chickens, one of my most special chickens, and she passed away just like a week before the book was released. But so knowing that she lives on in the book is some big consolation. I'm still heartbroken, but it's still, you know, but I'm so grateful that her story gets out there, and she does live on. Sorry, again, I got totally ahead of us there.
No, it's okay. And you know, when you mentioned your book and how you were going to publish a children's book, and the idea that, because if it was not for this podcast, I don't think I would have read your book. Because, right. You know, I'm a grown adult, so I'm not right. even interested in, you know, children's books. But right. I loved reading it. I truly did love reading it. I'm more than
thank you so much.
Yeah. I'm more than, you know, just
I appreciate that so much.
Went through it. I really read every page, and it did feel amazing. It had this dimension of, it felt like something real. It felt like it was based on mm-hmm. something real. Like, for instance, at one time you described the rescue operation of, you know, there's this tornado and you went on, well, not you, but I mean, I imagine you go on, you know, the site yeah. and went on this rescue operation, and it felt like this really happened. So I guess my first question for you is, how much of the book is based on real life stories?
Yeah, so a lot of it. I mean, I would say, like, when I went back and reread the story, it's so clear to me that I absolutely never could have written this story without my experience with the chickens. Like, the chickens pretty much wrote the story. I mean, I fleshed it out, but everything is either based in reality or at least inspired by reality. The scene with the chickens who come from the factory farm that's hit by a tornado, that is almost entirely based in reality. So like you said, you know, the character, the Abby character, who's kind of like me in the story, I didn't rescue, like I didn't go rescue the chickens, but there were rescuers. And I tried also to, the Abby character, who's kind of me, I really though in my mind's eye, like there were two other sanctuary owners who I tried to base the character on. There's a woman named Anissa Matheny who runs Mother Clucker's Micro Sanctuary, which is an amazing sanctuary. And everybody should go find her on social media and support her. And then there's another woman, Abby Hubbard, who runs Minnow and Blossom's Place. And I kind of like combined the two of them in my mind. They're just these, you know, wonderful, amazing women. And so it was a little bit of like a homage to them, like a little tribute to them. But it was during COVID. I saw a post in one of the chicken groups about a factory farm that had been hit by a tornado in Georgia. We had had storms in the area, and it was a factory farm about 6 hours from where I am. And the post that I saw, it was like the woman who posted was somebody who was really responsible for connecting me with every other chicken I had ever rescued up until that point. So a factory farm had hit a tornado had hit a factory farm, and like destroyed the buildings. And I feel like the first post I saw, we just knew that the tornado had hit the farm, and there, and we like assumed that there were survivors, but didn't necessarily know. And they were looking for people who could actually go and see if there were survivors. And it like killed me, but I couldn't leave because I didn't even, I think at the time, if I had any help, it was only a very small amount of help, but I had enough animals here that I just be gone, like, you know, 6 hour drive each way, and then you're on the ground for some amount of time. And I don't leave the animals alone here, except for, you know, I think maybe at the time, again, when I didn't have a helper here all the time, it was like, you know, if I had to go to the grocery store, I would leave them alone. But I just couldn't leave for such an extended period of time. And so it was like killing me to know that there were these, you know, potentially these animals in need who were pretty close to me and I couldn't go. But so I just said, I can't go. I'm so sorry. But if you find, you know, if there are survivors and you get them, I can take some. And then the conversation like went quiet for like 2 weeks. And I just thought that there hadn't been any survivors. And then about 2 weeks later, this person contacted me and asked if I could take 7 injured chickens from the factory farm. And I was like, what happened? I hadn't heard anything. I just thought, you know, that there hadn't been any survivors. And they said what had happened was that rescuers went in and they found the corner gone in with their bulldozers, and they were removing the quote wreckage, which included debris from the buildings, dead animals, but also live animals that they were just scooping up and burying. And rescuers went in, and the corporate owners called the police on them for trespassing. And I'm still not sure actually if anybody was arrested or if they were just threatened with arrest, but they basically had to kind of like go underground. And but they managed, you know, like going in at night when nobody, you know, when the wrecking crews were gone, they managed to pull out something like 200 birds. And some of them weren't even injured, but there were a lot that were injured. And by the time they rescued them, many of them had been there for like a week without food or water. It's amazing really that there were any survivors. But I ended up taking in 7. There's some, you know, some of the characters in the book are the ones that I rescued. They, you know, I tried to like reflect some of their personalities. But that's definitely their origin story is pretty accurate. And there's other, like at the beginning of the book, Fanny is rescued from a feed and seed, where she's like, she's a chick at feed and seed who's sickly. And the manager at the feed and seed says, you know, well, yeah, she's sick. We'll just put her in back and she'll probably die. And Abby, the human character, right, says like, is outraged as any normal person would be, and takes her to a vet and gets her the veterinary care that she deserves. And in the story, the manager's like, yeah, we don't get them veterinary care. And that, I've never viewed a chicken from a feed and seed, but I know a million people who have. Like almost every sanctuary has a chick who comes from, you know, a place like Tractor Supply. And it, you know, it's very, like throughout the book, it's, you know, just I tried to kind of weave in like just the truths of the industry and the world we live in. And, you know, based either on my own direct experience or on the experiences of other sanctuary people who I know. So there's like, yeah, you know, so much of the story is based in reality. There's like a turning point in the story where it takes on, you know, a whole kind of fantasy aspect, but it's interesting too, just what you said about, and I hate it so much, you know, that you said like you never would have read the story because it's a children's book, but that you really enjoyed it. And I'm just so grateful to hear that. And honestly, when I wrote it, I didn't know I was writing a children's book. It was really just kind of like a fantasy, like my own fantasy.
kind of creating this fantasy world where I could create a happy ending. And then, you know, after I had like the first draft, I kind of was like, oh, I think this is a children's book. And then I was mindful as I was writing it that like, oh, I don't want to include anything in here that would be like, you know, upset, like traumatizing. So, I tried to include references to like how sad and bleak life is for most chickens in reality, without it being so much, yeah, that, you know, children would need to get into therapy or something, you know?
Well, that's another question I was planning on asking, you know, what did not make the final cut? But first, I want to go back to the tornado story.
Yeah.
This made me think of, we're recording this in summer. This made me think of the heat waves and how that must impact farm animals across America and Canada. And this is something I don't think about usually. You know, in fact, before reading the book, I did not even cross my mind that there are animals suffering from the heat of the summer. Actually, I was just thinking of, you know, pool parties and drinking cold beverages and all of that, which is all wholesome and but it just escapes from our mind, you know, all this pain going on in the world, even if it is close to us. You know, I don't live far from farms, you know, even industrial farms. And I think it's important to have books that link you to reality, that, you know, sends you to explore and think of the world outside of the library, outside of the book, instead of books that just, you know, create more denial and more, you know, false ideas. And with that segue, I want to talk about other depictions of, you know, animals in children's books, because there are other books with, you know, talking chickens or talking any number of animals out there. And I often think, you know, when I look at them, I think if they could speak, they would talk about human cruelty. And they never do. So in this sense, this book is original and more accurate. but yeah, what do you think of talking animals and this idea of giving a human voice to animals? How did you think about it in terms of the creative process, and where do you put the limits of that exercise? Because at the end, Fanny, and I love this creative arc of the book, starting more, you know, human-centric, but then it becomes more and more about animals. They become the central voices of the book. But at the same time, those are human voices, because animals don't have voices. So, you know, just walk us through this creative process of yours and how you thought about it.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. That's a great, rich question. So I honestly, like, when I'm posting, for example, for the sanctuary, and posting about the animals from the sanctuary, I almost never sort of like give them a human voice, because it feels like disingenuous. I just want, you know, like, I want to represent them as they are, without projecting anything onto them. But I also feel like, you know, like, the truth is, right, it's like animals, they do have voices, but most humans are not listening, don't
don't understand what they're saying, you know, like aren't trying to understand and don't understand and dismiss what they are communicating. But like they are communicating, right? I mean, you know, you go into, if you were to go into any of those, you know, hell holes like slaughterhouses and factory farms, they would all be screaming in pain and misery. And I just think, you know, for the most part, right, people aren't exposed to that. And we just block out the idea even that they're communicating anything. But so I feel like, you know, so much of what I wanted to do with this book and so much of what I think I am trying to always do in my advocacy generally is, so when I'm not taking care of the animals at the sanctuary, I'm writing, like, whether, so this is like my first children's book, but I'm always writing nonfiction. And I don't know if it's okay, like I'm just to reference another podcast, this other podcast that you did on psychedelics and veganism. I microdosed a few years ago, and I had like an epiphany during that experience that I was very much here to not to speak for the animals, but like to try to translate for them. Like it's like I feel very they are communicating, but they live in a world where nobody speaks their language or very few humans speak their language, right? And what I want more than anything is like the world to hear what they're saying. And I just feel like my hope is that I can in some way just be a translator. Like, you know, it's their message and I just want to help deliver it. I had another moment, not on psychedelics this time, but I had a moment where I was in a meditation in the woods, and I just sort of had a flash of like kind of communicating with nature and some kind of conversation. I heard a voice in my head like, I'm one of you, but I'm also one of them. Like I'm one of, you know, I'm an animal. We're all animals. Like I'm an animal, but I'm also a human. And so it's, you know, we as humans have this like unique capacity to speak for them to our own species, you know, to convey what their message is to our own species, that hopefully our species will, you know, humans are more likely to listen to other humans. And so, you know, giving the chickens human in this story, it felt like, for one, I really did want to center the animals. I didn't want it to be a story of like human, you know, the human savior. Even though in the story, right, Abby, who's like the caretaker slash kind of, you know, she's really the mom. She has a role, like, and we as humans, like, we have a role to you know, do what we can, do everything we can to help the animals. But it's not about us; it is about them. And like all of the qualities that I try, you know, when they kind of take over in the story, like, you know, and they show courage and bravery and they are those things, you know, and intelligence. And they're just right. They're communicating. I think like what they're communicating are things that if we are paying attention and we know them at all and just listening, like it's clear that they're saying these things. Like they're not saying it in English, you know, they're not using human language, but they're definitely saying, I love being free. I love being in the sunlight. I love dust bathing and you know, like and I don't want to be in this hellhole. And I love my life and I don't want to be killed young. I want to be treated with kindness and compassion. Like I gave them human language, but I tried very hard, you know, not to put words in their mouth that were inauthentic. I tried very much to just, you know, use human language to express what they are expressing. And so, you know, and again, much of what I included is based on my experience living with them in this sanctuary environment and getting to see what they love and getting to see them thrive and like what makes them happy. And people, we've talked about for like many years, the whole worry about anthropomorphizing animals. And I think that there's like thought that that's just nonsense. Like, it's possible to do that, but to like attribute the wish to be free from suffering to an animal, like that's not anthropomorphic. Like that is of every sentient being wants to be free from pain and suffering. Every sentient being wants to be given the opportunity to thrive, to be treated with kindness and compassion and mercy. Yeah, I guess I think like, you know, if we're going to give them human voices, I just think we have to be careful that we're not giving them like human centric thoughts that, you know, it's just kind of like imagining, I think, you know, a French speaker and just trying our best. If we're a translator, we're trying to communicate what a French speaker is saying to an English speaker. It's like doing our best to be faithful to what they're saying. And in my way, I tried to be faithful to what I feel like the animals are saying and not just human voices to make them cute or something. You know what I mean? Like, I think people do that. It's like, how else do we communicate with humans what they need? Because there are some of us, you know, vegans, obviously, we like hear something that other people don't. We understand something that other people don't. Like, we are able to hear what the animals are saying, and non-vegans, either they can't hear it or they don't want to hear it. And so making it easier for people to understand what they're saying, I think that's, you know, that I think that was the goal. And also just, you know, wanting to write a story the animals were the main characters moving the action and kind of like in control of their own destiny.
Well, it is fascinating, the answers that you have offered, and I long to think of it. Now I will use the word translate.
Nice.
Yeah, I love that. I love that way of looking at it. And yeah, if I think of the stories I was told and where, you know, animals were the heroes, you know, from my childhood, I think of the fables of La Fontaine, you know, or that, you know, Puss in Boots story. And there the animal is not a sentient being. It's more of a symbol of something, and a way to express an idea. So it's more a figure of style than really a character with personhood and presence in the story. Mm-hmm. So in that, it's very revolutionary in a way, the way you write about, you know, animals as being more than symbols in a story. And I think it's a reflection of the whole vegan and animal rights movement. I think that in 100 years or more, if we're still around and there are historians, you know, studying the past, they will look at the vegan movement as a whole, you know, social movement, and try and the way they will depict that will be, you know, to talk about vegan art and vegan literature and all of that culture that was produced by the vegan movement. So do you see yourself as being, you know, a product, and your work as being a product of that movement?
Oh, very much. I mean, I feel like, you know, I wanted to write a story that, well, I mean, again, like, I didn't even set out to write it. It just kind of came to me. One day I was actually driving to LSU Veterinary Hospital, which is about 4.5 hours from here, to see an avian specialist with one of the sick roosters. And I don't know. It just like, you know, the idea just came to me, which doesn't happen often in my writing. Normally my writing is like nonfiction and it's more labored. And this was more like real, just sort of inspiration hit me, you know. But so I say I wanted to write a story, but I didn't really like set out to write a story. But I do, you know, at some point it's like, yeah, you want to write a story that's going to be engaging and entertaining. But I mean, it's advocacy. You know, like the number one sort of goal is advocacy. And very much feels like a product of, and a, you know, a product of this movement and the ideology behind the movement. And again, you know, really so informed by life, you know, sanctuary life and getting to know the animals. And I think, you know, so much of the goal of sanctuary is to tell the stories of the animals. And, you know, we do that in a lot of ways. And obviously, like, this is a fictional story, but it's so much based in reality that it, you know, it feels like it is telling their story. It's just a you know, with a little creative license in order to envision a different path forward, an alternate future, like one we could have if we just make some different choices that seem like so simple and clear. But yeah, I mean, I think that it's definitely, you know, a product of this worldview that, you know, is part of the animal rights movement and what veganism is all about. I mean, it's funny because, yeah, my grandma wrote children's stories. So I have it kind of in my genes, but my grandma wasn't writing books about like liberation for, you know, animal liberation. So I feel like, yeah, I have it in me. I've written for a lot, like ever since I was a kid, writing just was the way I processed the world. And, you know, I always sort of felt like I wanted to communicate through that form. Yeah, it's definitely informed by the animal rights world and, you know, the vegan ethic. My hope is that it will have, you know, that my hope is that it will be some kind of effective advocacy. But while also being like a, you know, an entertaining story.
Well, then let's talk about the readers. And because I think we have established that there is enough breadth and I guess not complexity, but a sense of, you know, deepness, is that word? To the story that can interest the parents, you know, the adults. And I think that's important for children's books, you know. The parents need to feel a bit, you know, entertained and stimulated from reading those stories.
Yeah.
But let's talk about, you know, how this story is, like you said, very much, you know, an activist story. And you know, Fanny goes to Washington. There is a political dimension to it, and that isn't something we often see in modern day stories, which is surprising because, you know, I grew up with the old fashioned stories, and they always talked about, you know, the monarchy and princes, and so the, you know, the political class of that time, you know, was reflected in the stories of that period of time. But modern stories nowadays, you know, doesn't reference our, you know, political leaders that much. It's like we make them politically secular in a sense, you know, politically free. So did you have hesitations of, you know, talking politics to and activism to children?
I definitely didn't want it to be like too political, that it would like alienate too many people. But I feel like, I don't know, I mean, it's a story about changing the world, and that it was like unavoidable, I think, to bring in, you know, it's like when I think about like what needs to change for the animals, well, it is inherently political. I mean, it's beyond politics, and that it's an ethical issue, right? And so there's like a little hesitation too, just even like I brought in Senator Cory Booker is in the book, right? And you know, I'm sure that there are some people who don't, on the other side of the aisle, who maybe would be off by that, but it's an ethical issue. And you know, he's somebody who stands up for justice and who has taken on the factory farming world. And that's like beyond politics. It's just, you know, politics are the way that we implement political philosophy and moral philosophy. And so you know, it just seems like it was, you know, from the beginning, it was like the flavor of, I think like what the first sort of kernel of an idea was, saw them in Washington. So from the, you know, it was that, but again, I did want to run it in a way that's like, it's not like partisan, it's political, not partisan. Right. Yeah. But I think, I mean, it's interesting though, just, you know, what you're saying, older story, and how, you know, how modern stories just don't contain any of that. You know, I mean, I guess that's the difference between books that are, you know, more philosophical or more about, you know, trying to make change. And maybe you don't see that a lot in children's books, books about, you know, social justice. But you know, part of the book, I mean, it's like, it's about animal rights, but it's also, I think, you know, I mean, it's like in the book, Fanny is this freedom fighter and she's this activist. And I do hope that, you know, kids would read it and feel inspired, that they too could, they, you know, inspired by Fanny, and that they too could be activists and can fight for change and a better world. But it is funny, I guess, yeah, that's not the subject of a lot of children's books, but at the same time, right, I mean, we all grow up, like, we have heroes and role models when we grow up, and, like, where are they coming from if not children's books? I mean, for me, like, growing up, I remember, you know, it was, like, Wonder Woman, hero, and there was a TV show about an Egyptian goddess, but there were like these strong women, I feel like, who were really my role models and heroes. And then I think about like the children's books that I grew up with, and often it was just animals who I loved. It was a lot of, yeah, I mean, a lot of my favorite children's books when I was a kid, that was like the Beatrix Potter book. So not, you know, not political, they were very much though, like, they inspired an awe and wonder for animals, and you know, off stories where the animals are, they're full of personality, that you really connect with, and so, you know, in some way, right, I guess, yeah, it's like those stories, even though they're not like overtly political or about social change like mine is, they are books that instill this idea that animals are, you know, people too, that like animals have personality and personhood, and that they're like these wonderful individuals who we want to, you know, we feel like we want to respect and love. So, yeah, I mean, it is, you know, different ways, I guess. But I feel like sometimes too with veganism is like, I feel like you have to make connections a little bit more clear for people. In the world that we live in, like that willful blindness and cognitive dissonance is so strong. But if you don't overtly make the connection, it's just too easy for people to miss it. So I think part of why maybe in my story, it wasn't enough just to write a story about sweet chickens. Like, I had to make it clear what they need. You can't just like be like, oh, the chickens are cute, close the book and go get in line at Chick-fil-A. No.
And I don't know if you targeted also meat eaters, because I was thinking, who is going to get this book? Well, yeah. Mostly vegans, and they want this book. They truly want, because maybe one of the greatest fear of vegan parents is to, raise children who then will, become meat eaters and just forsake all of those anti-species and vegan values. What do you think of that concern?
Yeah, I mean, that's really interesting. And it's funny because I have friends who have like chosen not to have kids, in part because they're like, well, because you can't control what kind of people your kids will be. And what if they end up being meat eaters? And, I don't know. I mean, I feel like I'm sure, yeah, that every vegan, so I don't have any human children. If I ever did, I can't imagine if they turned out not to be vegan, right? I mean, I'm sure every vegan parent hopes that they will adopt the same values. And so, having children's books, vegan families that reinforce the values, that does seem like, I'm happy to be able to, to offer a book to those families. And I do think that it's, vegans and vegan families will be the first wave of readers. My hope is that, the vegans who read the book will want to share it with their non-vegan friends and family, like all those pre-vegans out there. With everything. I mean, yeah, I definitely see that there's value in having a story for vegan families. But I, especially if there are like children at risk. It's so funny, right? Like in the world, it's like in the non-vegan world, it's like at risk of drug use or something. In the vegan world, it's like at risk of eating animals. So yeah, for those at risk vegan youth, I'm really happy that there's another story for them, especially to, like, sanctuary, right? We focus on chickens. And in my advocacy, I've started rescuing chickens, advocacy has really shifted to focus on chickens. In large part, as 9 out of the 10 billion land animals that we kill every year for food are chickens. So they represent the vast majority of animals, of land animals who we're killing and abusing so terribly for food. But also just because I think that they're just undervalued across the board, like regardless of the numbers involved, which should make them in so many ways the ones that we are advocating for the most. I think even animal lovers, like even, myself included, like before I had chickens and knew them as individuals, I didn't love them as much as I loved like cows and pigs and other mammals. And the more I've gotten to know them, the more I see that they're just these amazing, special, sweet individual people with, just as much personality as my dogs and my cats. And they just like want so much for the movement to really be focused. To focus on chickens, to give them the same attention that other animals get. And then again, with like the recognition too, that, people eat more chickens than any other land animals. And I feel like too, like, as much as I think people are starting to make the connection between the environment and like eating certain animals like cows and sheep, there are lots of, you know, so many environmentalists, like they'll give up beef and they'll start eating more chickens. And so I just think, like, in so many ways, the chickens need, like, I actually read this great book. Anna Ritchie wrote this book. I think it's Not the End of the World, maybe. It's this, like, great environmental book. She's vegan, but she sells out the chickens in the book. Like, it's all about how, you know, like, you can't be an environmentalist and eat and dairy, you know, dairy or lamb. She basically says, like, but she isn't that much better than being vegan. Like, and she's like, and the whole world isn't going to go vegan. And I heard her interviewed, and I heard her say that she stopped eating chickens because of the animal suffering, not because of the environmental impact. But she doesn't even make that point in the book. Like, I just feel like people can, you know, read that book, and there's so much messaging that comes out of the environmental movement that leads people to eat more chickens. So for all of those reasons, you know, I really wanted to center chickens. And then going back to, like, the vegan families who might be reading the book, like, you know, it's important for vegans. I think even, you know, there's like a little advocacy even for vegans, like the chickens matter, that, you know, we should all love the chickens. But my real hope is that it will, that, you know, vegans will love it enough that they will share it with their non-vegan, you know, their pre-vegan friends and families, and that it'll plant some seeds or water seeds. Those kids who have it in them, who don't want to eat animals, but they live, you know, they're in non-vegan families where their parents are just putting meat on the table. My cousin Lola, actually, so she's another, she's in the book. And my cousin, so she's my second cousin, the daughter of my cousin Doug. Doug is not a vegan. She's not been raised vegan. But the last I heard, she's been saying things like, animals are my friends, I don't want to eat them. And, you know, I feel like, yeah, I hope that this book will make its way into families like that, where there's like a kid in the family who's a vegan at heart, and they're in that period of time where, you know, I think there are so many kids, right, who they love animals. They would love to be vegan if their families would support that. And, you know, so you had to, non-vegan parents would have to be open-minded enough, right? And unfortunately, there aren't enough open-minded people in the world. But my hope is it will make its way into those homes.
Yes, 100%. You know, the book will be part of the toolkit of vegan advocacy now. Mm-hmm. You know, we will have this additional tool. But outside of this, you know, concern of having children that turn out non-vegan, there are many vegans who adhere to the ideology of anti-natalism. Mm-hmm. And I would love to have, you know, your opinion on that, because I think from an individual perspective, yes, not having children might contribute to your happiness and to the overall happiness of the world. I mean, there is an argument for that. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I will never, you know, advocate for anti-natalism because I've heard too many parents talk about, you know, the joy of having children and the meaning of that. And also, I am a product of parents, you know, who made the choice of having a child. So how can I even before, you know, this anti-natalism ideology? That would mean, you know, being against myself or against the very pulsion or, you know, idea that made me, which is alienating, and I don't think very healthy for your psyche. And also there's the fact that in general, although there will be plenty of kids from vegan parents, vegan families who will choose not to be vegan, I do believe that just like religion, just like political leanings, the most, you know, the majority of children that came from a vegan family will become vegan themselves. and will be part of that, whether they want it or not, will be part of that vegan advocacy efforts. Because all of a sudden, you have at school, you have at, what's it called? You know, the place where the very little ones are kept.
Preschool? Nursery school.
You know, you'll have vegans in nursery school, little vegans. Veganism will be represented in those very important places. Mm-hmm. And that's essential. That's essential to give to this world, you know, vegans from birth. So what are your thoughts about this antinatalism ideology that is spreading in the vegan community?
Yeah, I mean, it's a big topic. I have lots of thoughts. Let me see if I can string them together. So, I don't have human children, and I turned 50 this year. So I think that ship has sailed, and I'm probably not going to have them. I wasn't though like one of those people who set out never to have them. It just didn't happen. And I also wasn't one of those people who knew from like an early age that I really wanted a family. It was sort of like something I thought maybe I would do eventually. And then like I did other things, you know? I think I totally respect, you know, anybody who says I don't want to have children. I think that is 100%, you know, it's just a very individual choice. And I think the people who don't want to have kids because they want to do other things, great. And I agree. And I think that people who are having kids who aren't vegan, I think like that's a problem, you know, honestly. Right. But I think there was a time when I thought that what I was, you know, I thought from what I was reading and that we really, you know, that overpopulation was such a problem or such a risk for the future that it really was like the responsible thing not to have children, or if we are going to have children, to limit ourselves to one. But I feel like the more that I learn about the environment and environmental issues and population issues, like the truth is, if we were all vegan, we would be fine. And overpopulation is, I just don't think it's the concern that I thought it was like 5 or 10 years ago. I mean, I guess I hear kind of conflicting issues. I hear a lot of other people saying that we might have an underpopulation. Like it's a global issue, but there may be underpopulation in certain countries and overpopulation in other countries. And I think the most important thing is that we are raising, you know, that we are living in a sustainable way and in an ethical way. And I agree with you. I think like, yeah, there's no, my just anecdotally, like friends of mine who are vegan, where both parents are vegan, they all have vegan kids. Friends of mine where like one parent is vegetarian or vegan and the other parent is not, and they've like given their kids a choice, those kids are not vegan. But from my experience, and I'm sure that there's, you know, some research out there, but I haven't seen it, but I agree with you that it seems like vegan families generally have vegan kids. And I often actually think about like, you know, what impact I will have in the world, right? Like if I die tomorrow, have I done any good? Like, have I done enough that the world is, you know, there's any less suffering in the world? And I think about this every day. I'm a little bit obsessed with dying. Like I think about it almost every day. Or probably I do think about it every day. And I think like, you know, if I had had children who were vegan, then there would be some comfort, I think, in like, oh, well, when I'm gone, I've left people here who will continue the work. My dad died a few years ago, and I went vegan before my dad did, but he went vegan soon after I did. And I went vegan because of the values that he instilled in me. Like he 100% instilled my love of animals. Like I mean, you know, it's like, who would I be if he wasn't my dad? Well, I wouldn't be. But, you know, without that influence, like, I don't know if there's anything. I sometimes do believe actually that there is something innate within, there is compassion, you know, that's innate within all of us. But my dad very, very like directly taught me to compassion for animals. So I think about, you know, he died younger than he wanted to die. I don't know if he was really pretty haunted, especially, I mean, I think the whole time actually that he was vegan, he was pretty haunted thinking about all of the suffering. But I think he would have to be so pleased that like I carry on his compassion and that everything I'm doing, and you know, for as much as I wish I had more impact and I could help more animals, like everything I do every single day is designed to reduce suffering and create a better world for the animals. And you know, that came from him and it carries on through me. And then I think about the like, but I don't have children, so there isn't anybody else who's going to carry that on, like, because I birthed them, you know. So there's like, in Buddhism, there's this idea that our continuation is our actions. And I think about that a lot. Like, you know, I hope that I will have done enough that like it will ripple out. And, you know, things like this little book, like I hope it will ripple out and have some impact that will continue on. But I feel like, you know, yeah, if you're having children and you're raising them to be ethical people, then they can continue that. And the world needs, you know, like right now, you know, like all the MAGA people aren't worried about overpopulation. Sorry. Just to get real political. But I mean, really, you know, like, I'm sorry, but you know, like Donald Trump doesn't believe in climate change. Like his sons are trophy hunters. Like if those are the people who are having children, that's not, that can't work out well. So again, I totally respect anybody who just decides not to have children. Most of my friends, you know, I don't have children. Most of my friends don't have human children. Most of my friends have sanctuaries or they rescue dogs or cats. And, you know, these are like my people. So I see it in both sides. But I don't think like anybody should be like, especially, you know, if you're bringing a vegan kid into the world, I don't think anybody should be shaming you over it. Like, good for you. And, you know, there's a part of me, if I were 25 right now, I think I might be like, I might be open to having a little vegan baby, you know? So I hope that, yeah, I just hope all the babies that are born are vegans.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great point you're bringing up, you know, the strategic thinking behind it, you know, because yes, the people who are not vegans, and in fact, who believe the opposite of the things vegans believe, they're having children. They're not playing with ideas like antinatalism and being all idealistic and philosophical about those concrete life choices. They're right. Just, you know, it's like the movie Idiocracy, you know, where you have, you know, the smart couple who is waiting to have a child, and at the end they're not having any, and the other, anyway, just watch the movie. Yeah. The yeah. opening is yeah. epic, but yeah, they're multiplying. And at the same time, what, you have a vegan population that will be in decline in the next decades because of antinatalism? It's a concern. I guess it's a real concern. So I want to turn to continue on the lane of activism and ask a question that is at the heart of not only your book, but mm-hmm. also this podcast. And that was our very, you know, positive experience I had of, you know, reading the book and being surprised of how it was in line with this podcast, you know, the mission of this podcast, mm-hmm. which mm-hmm. is to invite vegans to do more than just being vegan. Mm-hmm. And so let me ask you this, Tracy, directly. Is it enough to just be vegan? Actually, I've asked this question in a very biased way. Is it enough to be vegan? Which is already a lot, you know, you're doing a lot. But is it enough?
Right, is it enough? I mean, like you said, it's you're doing a lot by being vegan. Like, that is absolutely, you know, it's the first step. It's the big step. It's the hardest step. Is going vegan, right? It's like accepting everything you have to accept in order to decide that you're going to be vegan. Like, it's the hardest, like, psychologically. But yeah, once you're vegan, you know, our impact is really pretty small if we're just eating vegan food and not talking about it to anybody. Like, we do really need to grow, the community. Like, if we're going to reach that tipping point, right? Like, you know, where we can really change the world for animals and create a different world. And I mean, we're not just going vegan for our own health, right? I mean, that's it. It's like, right, if you're going vegan because you have heart disease and you're trying to reverse your heart disease or something, then it is just about you. And then that's what it is. But veganism is really, it's a social movement. It's about changing the world. It's about creating a better world, a more compassionate world, a more just world, a more sustainable world. And it's great to, like, stop contributing to the problem. But I do think if we're going to have the vegan world that we all want, then we do need to do whatever we can to spread these ideas and this, you know, lifestyle, philosophy, ethic. You know, we're trying to, like, create a whole new paradigm and a whole new norm in society. We won't do that by just, like, sitting at home isolated in our, you know, in our own homes eating vegan food and not talking about it. So, I mean, I think there are so many different ways to do more is the thing, right? I mean, it's almost hard not to do more. Like, you know, I feel like you would just talking to people is doing more. Talking to people in the most, I mean, talking to people, of course, is hard. That is actually, it's super hard to figure out how to communicate with non-vegans in a way that is likely to bring them over onto our side and not push them away. And, you know, it's like tactics are huge. And, you know, there are some good books out there about the best way to create a vegan world and have these conversations. And I do think that we have to be thoughtful about it, like how we communicate the message, because we can do more harm than good if we're communicating in you know, the wrong way. And so I think, like, I understand, I think, some hesitation to do more because it is hard to communicate with non-vegans. I find it a lot easier to communicate, like, well, I mean, that's so much of why I write, is that I feel like I can put something out to, like, a general audience. There's nobody like right in front of me who's going to be offended. You know, I think people can read things, like, on their own time. They can process things without feeling, like, judged by somebody in their face. But again, like, there's so many different ways. There's, you know, you can do protests. You can write. You can do films. Do social media. You know, there's, like, all these people on social media who are doing all kinds of creative things with their content. You can also write, like, yeah, just going to work for, like, any of the vegan organizations, whether it's, like, doing direct advocacy or, like, meat alternatives or, you know, in any profession, you can find a way to, like, promote the vegan message. Like, if you're a journalist and focus on, like, you know, animal-friendly stories or, I mean, I just think, yeah, it's like across the board, whatever we do, there are ways to bring our veganism and bring these ethics into what we do and further the cause. So, yeah, I totally am with you. I think it's really important that we do more than just quietly eat our tofu sandwiches or something, you know?
Thank you, Tracy. before we end this conversation, I said I would ask you that. What did you, what did not make the final cut of the book? What did you left out of the book? I'm very curious about that. It's one of my favorite questions to ask a writer.
Yeah, interesting. I have to think. I have a whole file of cuts. I should go back and look actually at some point. I'm sure that there were some, I'm sure there was like a little bit more, just like, you know, as I was going through and rewriting, and I don't even know how long it like stayed in the draft, but I'm sure that there was like a little bit more graphic, description of like factory farming, or even like the tornado survivors' injuries. Like, I feel, I think some of that, and now I can't remember if something stayed in. Oh, there's a little bit, maybe, yeah. But I think maybe I took out some of the details that I just thought were like maybe a little too heavy. I know at some point, well, my editor, I have a small publishing company and an editor, he took out some things that were nothing like, I had to push back. He wanted to take out the very last line. I don't know if I should give it away. It's not really like a cliffhanger, but the very last line of the book, can I say it? Do you think that gives anything away? I don't think so. Right.
The last line
of the book is, until every cage is empty, until every being is free. And he wanted to take that out because he thought it was like overkill, that like we had already made the point. And I was like, oh my gosh, no, like that is like, that just tie, that is what it's all about. It's like, it brings in the, like, you know, animal liberation vow. It also brings in the Bodhisattva vow from the Buddhist tradition, which is about, there's this idea, right, that like, as we walk on the path towards enlightenment, like there's a point where we could like go to nirvana basically, right? And the Bodhisattva path is the path of the one who decides to stay in the realm of birth and death, like in samsara, in this world of suffering, that we stay here until every last being is free. You know, it's like that thing, like instead of closing our eyes and walking putting on our blinders and pretending the suffering isn't there, we lean in, we go in, and we pull them out. And just like, so that last line is so important to me to keep. So anyway, so I'm sorry, that's not a line that's not part of the cut, but it was like something I fought to keep in. There were some, there's like a few other little details that got taken out, like that were a little bit because I think, I don't even know if I said this, but when I first wrote it, right, I didn't really know I was writing a children's book. I just like wrote this sort of fantasy story. So I think that there were some like lines, maybe a little humor that my editor publisher thought was like inappropriate for kids, not even like inappropriate, but too much for kids, things they wouldn't understand. But I'm glad you still think that there's like, you know, that there's enough in there for parents. Cause I definitely was like, you know, even when I realized it was a children's story and I was going back and revising it, I thought there were things in there that maybe would go over a kid's head, but that's okay. And parents would get. And I feel like also just kind of going back to like the comics that I watched as a kid and stuff, there were always those kind of two layers, two levels, so that parents could be amused as well as the children. But yeah, I can't think of anything else specifically that was cut that was like anything significant. Just again, I think like some more graphic content and some more slightly more adult content, or just maybe like two big, you know, words that kids wouldn't understand or something. I can't think if there was anything else like major that I cut. I may just not be remembering now, but it was like I said though too, it's like, unlike so much of the other writing that I do, I feel like it just came in a way, you know, it sort of flowed in a way that so much of my writing does not. Like, so much of my writing is really laborious and feels kind of hard. And this just was like, I don't know, it just came. So there was less rewriting for sure than most of everything else I write.
Amazing.
But if I find anything like super interesting in a cut file, I'll let you know.
Well, I always recommend to publish what did not make the final cut, just out of curiosity for the nerdy readers like myself.
Yeah, that's so interesting.
Yeah, it makes me think of, like, you know, when they say, oh, do you know the real Cinderella story? And then there are all of those gory details. Well, it's a bit like that with Fanny Goes to Washington, I guess.
Yeah, there were a few more gory details. Yeah.
Well, Tracy, thank you so much. Thank you for having accepted my invitation. Thank you for writing this book and for all the work you're doing. Truly, it was a pleasure talking with you.
Oh, I appreciate it so much, Ryan. Thank you so much for what you're doing. I love the podcast. I'm so grateful and honored to be on it. And I also super enjoyed the conversation. So thank you so much. And I'm so glad that you, like, it makes me so happy that you really liked the book.
Thank you, everyone, for listening. I kindly invite you to share this podcast with the vegans you know. Let's encourage more people to take action. Again, thank you so much for caring, and I will see you next Tuesday for a new episode.